This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is made possible in part each Wednesday by People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do, a better business relationship. By Business Energy Action, challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. By Fairpoint Communications, small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. By Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. And by National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years, working for a better tomorrow. And by the over 1,000 VBSR members. Here's noted Vermont author David Goodman.
Welcome to this week's Vermont Conversation. Is our democracy for sale? That's our topic this week in the aftermath of a groundbreaking U.S. Supreme Court decision. On April 2nd, the U.S. Supreme Court decided in McCutcheon versus the Federal Election Commission to strike down aggregate limits on contributions to federal candidates, political parties, and political action committees, or PACs. This ruling makes it possible for individuals to contribute millions of dollars to candidates, parties, and PACs. Prior to the McCutcheon decision, an individual could contribute a maximum of $123,000 in any two-year election cycle, with sublimits of just over $48,000 to candidates and around $74,000 to PACs and political parties. However, following the ruling, an individual can use joint fundraising committees to contribute up to nearly $6 million to these entities. Robert Weissman, the president of Public Citizen, said, "Today's U.S. Supreme Court ruling strikes a devastating blow at the very foundation of our democracy." He continued, "There are literally only a few hundred people who can and will take advantage of this horrendous ruling, but those are exactly the people our elected officials will now be answering to. That is not a democracy, it is plutocracy," said Weissman of Public Citizen. Well, to talk about these issues on this week's show, in our second half hour, we'll have on Vermont Secretary of State Jim Condos. In our first half hour, we are joined by Akine Freechild, who is Senior Coordinator of the Democracy is for People, a project of Public Citizen, a watchdog group. Akine, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thanks for having me.
So, can you explain what is the new ground that this McCutcheon decision blazes that has not been open before?
I think the main thing, you did a beautiful job of summarizing what happened in McCutcheon, is already there was a very high limit on how much an individual could give directly to candidates and parties. It's twice what the median American family makes. And now they can write million-dollar checks to John Boehner's leadership PAC, Nancy Pelosi's leadership PAC, and new PACs that are now being created probably by the day to take advantage of the fact that you can give to as many PACs as you want as long as you give under the limit of around $74,000, which you mentioned. And as we all know, money sloshes around in politics. Candidates and parties transfer money back and forth. So what this fundamentally means is there is no more limit on how much you can give in a federal election in a two-year cycle. There's a limit on how much you can give each candidate, but we see that the money flows all over the place, and you will be certain that leadership of the parties will be well aware of who those few hundred people are who are writing the biggest checks. So it's incredibly devastating. You know, I've traveled and I've heard reports of other countries where a few hundred people control the government, and that is not the kind of country that we're designed to be, nor is it the kind of country that we want to be. It has disastrous outcomes for effective government.
Can you explain how this new McCutcheon decision differs from Citizen United?
Sure. So Citizens United had to do first with corporations, that means nonprofits, for-profits, as well as unions in this case, being able to spend money independently of candidates and parties. So there's still big in the game. There's still plenty of super PACs and nonprofits that will be spending in 2014. They do not have to disclose their donors if they spend through a 501c4 nonprofit. And so they're a way that corporations could give directly from Treasury. They usually, for-profits have a profit motive. They need to have a profit justification for spending. So that was fundamentally corrupting to have, CEOs basically investing in something where they expect a return. And that's not what taxpayers pay taxes for. They pay to have a government that functions as the people decide. So that was Citizens United, money outside of the parties and candidates, but being spent, as we saw, in coordination with them. As much as that is illegal, it's what we saw happening. And then now with McCutcheon, it's money directly to the candidates and parties. And the argument in Citizens United was, well, you know, as long as it's not directly with the candidates and parties, how could it be corruption? Because they won't know where the money is coming from. That clearly didn't work out as the court thought it would. But now, of course, you know, they knew where the money was coming from on the outside. But now that really close relationship between leadership of the parties and major fundraisers for the parties and these major donors is going to be even closer.
And so, you know, to give an example, with Citizen United, you had these large groups like Crossroads GPS that was run by Karl Rove, George Bush's, sort of chief strategist and fundraiser. But these would be raising money and spending money in parallel with this thin, very porous wall. And now that thin wall has simply been removed and the cash can just wash directly to the candidates for whatever purposes they want.
Right. And it's very disturbing because it basically says, hey, you know, there were 1,200 people that gave near the federal legal limit directly to candidates and parties last presidential election. Now those people can say, you know, if I don't want my name out there, I'll give through a nonprofit in the dark money side. And if I'm okay with disclosure, I can give to the party or I can give to both. Some folks have been saying, oh, now there's transparency because we'll know where the money that's flowing to the parties and the candidates is coming from, which is true, but that doesn't erase all the problems we had before. It's just made things worse.
So there were lots of kind of doomsday scenarios painted when Citizen United was passed by the Supreme Court in terms of the influence of money in politics. What happened? What did we see happen with Citizens United in terms of the quantity of money or how it was used?
Yeah, I think that there was a very specific fear that didn't play out the way we expected, and instead other problems came up that may be better but probably worse than what we expected. I think the fear after Citizens United was that we would just be bombarded and drown out with ads, especially people in swing states in the presidential election would be overwhelmed. They would vote based on the messages that they heard over and over and over again. There's good advertising science that says if you repeat something, eventually people believe it to be true. And so there was some concern that it would increase the amount of misinformation, make it very difficult for people to find out correct information and, affect the election in that way. I don't think that bore out. I think people in those swing states and places where there were very contested elections with a lot of outside, often secret spending, got sick of the ads and tuned them out more than was expected. They've definitely had an impact. But what we saw was an incredible amount of fear from elected officials that has really changed the landscape. It means that people of lesser means are less likely to run. They're less likely to vote because they don't feel their voices are being heard. They're less likely to run because they feel they need more money than ever in case they get attacked by a super PAC or an outside group. And then they feared voting with their conscience or voting as the entire country wanted them to in the case of, you know, background checks after Sandy Hook, or, you know, as their constituents want, because they could have $1 million or more dropped in their election from who knows where. It's very hard to respond at the last minute. And you saw, you know, severe gridlock in Congress getting much worse because folks, especially in the GOP, where there's split the party more than was expected, are afraid to vote their conscience and vote what their constituents want because there is a real threat of money being spent against them in primaries.
Is there a case in the aftermath of Citizens United that kind of stands out in your mind as where this new money made a big difference?
Well, I think the shutdown was that case. I think there was a lot of currents of people in Congress leaking out that they didn't want to be doing the shutdown, that it wasn't where they preferred to be, but they didn't feel they could behave in another way. And in terms of dark money, the Tea Party, at least until the last poll I saw, the last survey I saw, was outraising the moderate wing of the Republican Party. And so folks who were moderate, who could have broken the deadlock and ended the shutdown, chose not to because of that fear. And then you see a lot of those moderates retiring, and you see moderates on the Democratic side retiring, and pretty much anyone who just, you know, they already spent an incredible amount of time fundraising, an incredible amount of time just getting reelected every 2 years if you're in the House, and adding on to that is just too much. Really good people are leaving public service because of this.
One of the figures I'm looking at about the impact of Citizens United talks about in the 2012 cycle, non-party outside spending tripled and topped $1 billion for the first time, with super PACs accounting for more than $600 million of that. So breaking the $1 billion ceiling, that's a pretty notable outcome for Citizens
United. Absolutely. Yep. We expect to see maybe another $1 billion over the next 4 to 6 years, a very conservative estimate.
Right. And these dark money groups accounted for about a quarter of $1 billion of all this non-party spending. So what will McCutcheon add to that in practical terms? I mean, could we figure that a lot of these super rich donors that are capable of contributing this kind of money are, you know, we're already seeing how much they want to spend, or do you think we haven't even begun to see what they're capable of spending?
I unfortunately think it's just going to continue to escalate. As the pressure to raise money increases, there's going to be further outreach. And I also think there's some people who didn't want to give through super PACs for whatever reason. Maybe they do want to disclose, and so they couldn't spend the maximum they wanted to, and now they can. So we'll see some of that. Those are the two factors. I think there's just a lot that we can't anticipate, and I think some of that's starting to be revealed with this sort of king-making ceremony that we saw with Sheldon Adelson gathering the GOP presidential hopefuls to discuss sort of how they would prioritize his specific individual agenda, because he is one of those few hundred people who's willing to spend.
And explain who bet. Sheldon Adelson is, and what this remarkable meeting that he held in Las Vegas, I think it was Las Vegas, what
right.
that was about.
Yeah, so Sheldon Adelson is the owner of the Sands Corporation, which owns a number of casinos in Asia and also in Las Vegas, but about 90% of his business is actually in Singapore and Hong Kong, I believe. And he is very concerned about Israel. He has a very specific point of view on Israel, and he wants, through this group, the Jewish Republican Organization, he's trying to get the presidential candidates to carry forth his specific agenda and his specific talking points. That's the impression that we've gotten since 2012, when he favored Newt Gingrich and kept Newt Gingrich in the race probably longer than he would have been, just by virtue of the amount of money that he was giving. So, you know, Chris Christie made a comment that Adelson didn't find particularly appetizing about how to refer to the Palestinian territories, and apologized, which is notable, and the first I've heard of Christie publicly apologizing.
Well, we should note that that's a step forward for Christie to apologize for something he's upset about rather than closing the George Washington Bridge. Sorry,
I
couldn't resist.
Right, but this, you know, this public parading before a single big donor is just, you know, there's only so much time to actually govern, and that's already incredibly reduced by the need to raise money. And the more money that gets in, the more time is going to be spent doing that, catering to the wishes of these few folks.
We're talking this week on the Vermont Conversation with Akine Freechild this half hour. She's the senior coordinator of the Democracy is for People project of Public Citizen. You can join the conversation by calling 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. We're talking about the impact of money in politics after the recent Supreme Court decision, the McCutcheon decision. Akine, you've been involved in responding to this decision, organizing rallies, among other things. Talk about some of the dimensions of the response since the decision was handed down just over a week ago.
Sure. There were 150 rallies and events in 41 states protesting the ruling. I know there were folks out in Montpelier and probably other places in Vermont as well. And just, you know, the same day, we had just a rapid response and an incredible amount of anger and fury and sadness coming from the grassroots. People who hadn't really engaged on money in politics before coming out and protesting and saying enough is enough. We have to return democracy to the people. And the way to do that is a constitutional amendment. You can't overturn the U.S. Supreme Court's interpretation of the U.S. Constitution, in this case, the First Amendment, claiming that big checks and elections are the same as leafleting or making a speech, is basically what they're saying here, without a constitutional amendment or changing the court and having the court reverse itself, which is not likely to happen anytime soon. We've done a constitutional amendment 27 times before in this nation, and we're no less of a people, a vibrant democratic force than our forebears. So I feel confident that it's possible. The same amendment that would overturn Citizens United would overturn McCutcheon. So we've already been on this path for 4 years, and our fight is getting bigger and stronger by the day.
What kind of congressional support do you have for this amendment at this point?
Last I checked, there's 150 co-sponsors on an amendment. Senator Sanders is a major leader on this issue. Representative Walsh has long supported it. And Senator Leahy held a hearing on it. We'd love to hear more conversation in Congress about the need for an amendment in the next couple of months. So we are encouraging folks to go to moneyout-votersin.org. That's moneyout-votersin.org. You can email your representative from there and ask them to make sure to prioritize this as an issue. Well, you know, Walsh is a co-sponsor, and we're grateful for that. We also need champions to be out there asking their colleagues to get on board as well.
What's it take to get a constitutional amendment passed?
That is a great question. You have to pass two-thirds of each house, which you kind of have to do for everything that goes through the Senate, it seems, these days. But it is no small feat. And then you have to have that amendment ratified by three-quarters of the states. So we've been working state by state and city by city building this movement, and Vermont, as you know, probably is the third state to call for a constitutional amendment. Now 16 states have done so, and about 550 towns have also called for an amendment, either through the legislature or through ballot initiative.
So what was the last time we had a constitutional amendment in this country that passed?
It actually was not that long ago, but it's kind of a funny one. It's one that was introduced, I believe, in 1789, and it was finally ratified in the 1990s, and it said that members of Congress can't raise their pay in the same session. So, you know, hopefully our movement won't take that long, basically since the founding of the country. But more recent ones that people might be more familiar with is the right of citizens to vote at 18, so that we weren't sending people into wars that weren't able to vote, and that was the 26th Amendment. More recent ones were around voting rights, around the poll tax in the 60s. That was the 24th Amendment. 23rd Amendment allowed District of Columbia to vote for president. So it's happened, you know, recently, but it is a fight, and something this controversial will definitely require a national movement.
We're talking with Akine Freechild from Public Citizen about the role of money in politics in the aftermath of the Supreme Court's McCutcheon decision. Is there, I mean, this sounds like a you know, a lengthy and difficult process to get a constitutional amendment passed. Are there things short of a constitutional amendment that could bring back some checks and balances into the system of money and politics?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's been a huge fight in New York State, for example, for public financing, so that if a candidate gets a certain number of small donations and there's matching funds beyond that, which incentivizes candidates to talk to people who can give small amounts because that money is unmatched sixfold, I believe, in the New York proposal. That did not pass the session, but I believe it will in the future. New York City has a similar system. So that really takes, you know, the big check donors a little bit more out of the equation, because folks can raise just as much money by talking to everyday folks who can maybe afford $20, $25. And it's shown that when there is a public financing system in place, small donors do tend to give, whereas otherwise they don't feel like they count. Also, disclosure. President Obama could actually require every corporation that has a contract with the federal government to disclose their political spending. He could do it tomorrow. And that would be an incredible step, because so many of the largest corporations do have contracts with the federal government. Or the Securities and Exchange Commission could require publicly held companies to disclose their political expenditures. So there's ways to open up and at least know where the money is coming from for the outside money. But at the end of the day, the only way we're going to be able to limit spending at the federal level is through a constitutional amendment. So I encourage folks to go to Overturn McCutcheon. That's Overturn, MCCUTCHEON.org.
We're also hearing that there are other court cases in the Supreme Court pipeline that relate to money and politics that may go even further than McCutcheon and Citizens United. What do you know about that?
Well, you know, we actually had a small victory in this terrible overall picture of how our democracy is doing. The court actually refused a challenge to an Iowa law that banned corporate contributions in state elections. And that's a direct contribution ban that only applies in the state of Iowa. But that was upheld, which we thought was really positive. It does seem like the court is very clearly hinting that they're inviting more challenges, and there are more challenges in the federal court pipeline, but I'm unfortunately not qualified to speak to their details.
I mean, it seems that the major obstacle to this kind of unlimited funding has really already been removed, because once we're now talking about the ability to donate up to $6 million in an election cycle, I mean, we really are just talking about what a few hundred people in this country can do. What other shoe can drop here on this that would make it worse?
You could remove all limits. You could just write that $6 million check to one Senate candidate. I mean, that is what we were worried about, and that's what Justice Thomas actually advocated for in his concurrence with the majority in the Supreme Court ruling in McCutcheon. So we're glad that they kept the basic limits, even though the way that money moves, it's not particularly meaningful unless you're a small-time donor who's not looking nationally at the overall races. But, you know, there's always ways to make it easier to bribe people legally, and that's what we're trying to avoid.
As somebody who is spending, you know, most of her working hours on the issue of trying to keep some sanity or limits in the world of, you know, dark money, corporate money's influence in elections, how are you feeling right now in the month of April 2014, you know, with where things are at?
I have a lot of hope, because we have incredible people on the ground that are working on these issues. Bill Butler in Montpelier is just one example of somebody who hasn't given up, who's been working on this for 4 years, reaching new people all the time. Ben Cohen from Ben & Jerry's has been traveling the country stamping money to stamp money out of politics. And just really incredible determined leadership that we have that led to these 150 events.
And so we're going to have to leave it there. Akine Freechild is a senior coordinator for the Democracy is People, a project of Public Citizen. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Staples has great deals on everything you need to tell the world about your amazing cupcake shop.
Try our amazing cupcakes.
From large in-store signs and banners to custom t-shirts and menus. Everything.
Try our amazing cupcakes?
Yeah, sure. Oh, this tastes like feet.
Except amazing cupcakes. Thousands of products added to Staples.com every day.
Uh-oh.
Even antacids. Now get 50% off marketing materials. Staples. Make more happen.
Offerings 5-14. Minimum quantities and exclusions apply. See store associate or staples.com/copy and print for details.
Psst. Hey, you, driving this car. You ever text and drive? Come on, be honest. I bet some of you are doing it now. Just a peek or a quick on my way. It's not hurting anybody, right? Wrong. You know it's dangerous. That's why cops are cracking down and writing tickets. So stop being stupid and stop texting while driving. End of conversation. You drive, you text, you pay. Paid for by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
AP Update, I'm Tim McGuire. Students and parents at Franklin High, just outside Pittsburgh, talk about today's stabbing incident inside the school. Hope DeMont tells KDKA-TV she saw two of the stabbing victims.
I see some kid holding his stomach and, like, running. So I walk out into the parking lot, and there was this kid laying down, and he was holding his side, and there was a teacher on top of him screaming, help.
For Lisa Bauer, relief when her son called.
He said, Mom, I'm okay. He said there was a stabbing at the school, and it's like your knees buckle, and you just thank God that you're hearing his voice.
That tape also from KDKA-TV. 19 students and an adult were injured. Two of the four who are in critical condition are at Forbes Medical Center. Chief Medical Officer Dr. Mark Rubino is confident all the victims in his hospital will recover.
One thing about youth is they are resilient. You know, someone who is younger and strong can often tolerate these injuries better than someone else.
AP Update, I'm Tim McGuire.
Having a new website designed? Think Beyond PCs, whose sales are dropping worldwide. PowerShift and Stowe designs responsive websites which work beautifully on smartphones, tablets, and computers. It's a fast-paced world. People want your information now, on the go. Your webpage needs to look professional and function quickly and easily on all devices. PowerShift designers work with you side by side and can teach you to manage your site without unnecessary expense and hassle. PowerShift and Stowe, pshift.com.
Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility makes the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman available each Wednesday, along with People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do. A better business relationship. National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years working for a better tomorrow. Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. Fairpoint Communications. Small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. And Business Energy Action. Challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. As well as over 1,000 plus VBSR members.
Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation, where this week we're talking about the role of money in politics. We've been discussing the recent Supreme Court ruling that was handed down last week that makes it possible, this is the McCutcheon ruling, for individuals to contribute millions of dollars to candidates, parties, and PACs. Well, here to talk about the impact of this and other recent decisions on Vermont is Vermont Secretary of State Jim Condos. Secretary Condos, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you, David. I'm glad to be here.
So Senator Bernie Sanders has described McCutcheon as offering the, quote, freedom to buy the U.S. government. Do you agree with that?
I do have agreement with Senator Sanders and further his comments about slowly developing an oligarchy in the United States. And if you go to Webster's dictionary, you'll find that the definition for oligarchy is actually government by the few, or a government in which a small group exercises control. And I think that's the problem that we're heading towards. And I am very disappointed by the recent ruling in McCutcheon, but also by the ruling in Citizens United before that.
So as part of your job, you oversee campaign finance in Vermont. What do you see as being the impact of these decisions on Vermont elections?
Well, we already saw some of the impacts of the Citizens United with a super PAC here in Vermont, that an independent expenditure PAC, which spent $1 million, and basically, you know, we knew who it was, but that it was difficult at times to understand when the money was being spent and whatever, according to our system. And that's one of the things that I think is really concerning here with the McCutcheon ruling. I know that there have been a few folks who have said that McCutcheon doesn't really impact Vermont, but I disagree, because I think it does. When you look at, there was a provision in the recent campaign finance law that actually was a trigger to the McCutcheon decision, and in this case, because of the way the decision went, the trigger was never pulled, so it's not going into place, and that is the aggregate limits that someone could spend.
So you were just referring to, I'm assuming, Lenore Broughton, the conservative funder, who lives in Burlington, that she spent $1 million in was it the, just the last election cycle supporting? So had that had we ever broken that ceiling before in Vermont, the $1 million ceiling from one spender?
Not that I'm aware of. That I believe is that was the first time. I think that it's clearly a place that I'm not sure Vermont wants to go to. You know, our whether it's a House seat, a Senate seat, or a statewide seat, with the exception of perhaps the governor's race, those races are relatively small in dollars. They're not big dollar items like you see in other states.
Right. I think the New York Times just quoted Chris Pearson of the Progressive Party as sort of lauding the fact that many House candidates run on campaign budgets of $5,000 or less. And did I read that you had raised, I just saw the headline, I didn't read the article, but in your last campaign cycle, how much did you raise?
Well, it's not fair to look at my 2012, because I really only had a minor party race against me, but in that race, I don't even recall the exact number, but I raised less than $30,000 and had some expenses that I paid off. I think prior to that, though, in the 2010 election, I spent less than $100,000. I raised and spent less than $100,000, including in-kind contributions. So I think I raised somewhere around $86,000 or $87,000 and spent around $90,000, but I don't recall exactly.
Is the average expenditure for state candidates in Vermont, has it changed much in recent years?
Statewide candidates?
Yes.
I think it's starting to ramp up, which is a concern. If you look at the last election cycle, you had the lieutenant governor spending over $200,000 or around $200,000. And then in the treasurer's race, there was a tremendous amount of money spent. You know, one was the incumbent, the current incumbent, was raising money to try to offset the independent expenditure PAC money that was being spent against her. And it begins to create a race to the top to see who can spend the most money. And I really think that goes against our grain. It's not what Vermont or Americans want to see.
Can you just give us a quick thumbnail of the recent history of Vermont's campaign finance laws? People recall that we landed in the Supreme Court. So just give us a quick overview of what's happened locally.
Well, sure. Back in 1997, the legislature actually passed a new campaign finance law, which created limits of $200 for a representative, $300 maximum contribution for a Senate, or a county candidate, and $400 for a statewide, and a $2,000 for a PAC to donate. That law was challenged almost immediately and ended up the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme, it went to the Supreme Court and came down to the ruling of the contribution limits were ruled unconstitutional, and under the advice of the Attorney General's office and Ledge Counsel, the legislature just assumed that we would go back to the pre-97 law, which actually is the current limits that we've been working on the last three election cycles of $2,000 maximum contributions. And then we've tried several times. I was actually chair of the Senate Committee on Government Operations that worked on some of this language at the time that the Supreme Court came down. But further, and I think it was 2007 and 2008, two different campaign finance laws were passed by the legislature, but then were later vetoed by then Governor Douglas. And then there was no action taken until this past year, when the legislature took up the issue again, S-82 passed, and essentially the limits, there's been kind of a misnomer that all the limits went up, but that's not quite true. There were many cases of the limits coming down, but there were some problematic areas, I think.
So at this point, then, the basic story in Vermont is you can give up. Well, you tell us.
All right. You mean what the limits are? Is that
yes.
What you're looking for?
Yeah.
Okay. For a House member, the current limits now are $1,000. They were reduced from the $2,000. For the Senate, they were reduced from $2,000 down to $1,500. This is per election, two-year election cycle. The statewide candidates was increased from $2,000 for a two-year cycle to $4,000 for a two-year cycle, and the PAC contributions were reduced from $6,000 down to $4,000. So you had several cases where the actual limits went down. The problematic one, I think, for some folks has been what has been perceived as something new, and that is that unlimited spending from parties to candidates. That was actually in effect before. That is not new language. That was already in effect. And the legislature, one of the legislature's concerns with regard to the party contributions to individual candidates is that what are parties for? They're there to elect candidates. And the second thing is that parties are being hamstrung by super PACs or independent expenditure PACs who can spend unlimited amounts of money, raise and spend unlimited amounts of money. The parties are still have limits as to how much money they can raise from a candidate or from a donor, but there's this unlimited donation to a candidate. And, you know, even with unlimited donations from parties to candidates, we've seen very, very little of that over the years.
So the McCutcheon decision applies just to federal elections. Is that correct?
Yeah. In this particular instance, it does apply to federal elections, but it's a ruling that everybody looks at, all the states will look at. And that's one of the concerns is that what this does is it hamstrings the states as they attempt to try to limit campaign finance contributions. I mean, you also had in that decision, Justice Clarence Thomas stated that if he had his way, he would strip away all contribution limits. And that was a concern when this this lawsuit was working its way to the top. There was a concern by many that the U.S. Supreme Court would do away with contribution limits altogether. So it was certainly good from that standpoint that it did not happen, but clearly Justice Thomas wishes that he could strip away all contribution limits. My only comment to that would be absolutely wrong for America and certainly wrong for Vermont.
Well, what is the trickle-down of McCutcheon, the McCutcheon decision to Vermont, to these statewide elections?
Well, directly, the direct link is actually that now our aggregate limit that we were trying, that Vermont was trying to put in place, is no longer going to, is not going to be triggered. That's the direct relationship. In essence, McCutcheon really doesn't affect us otherwise, but in that particular instance, it just won't trigger that segment of the bill that was passed in January.
Does it signal that state limits such as Vermont's would be vulnerable to being struck down if they were brought to, up through the courts to the Supreme Court again?
I think, yes, absolutely. If Vermont were to go forward with the aggregate limit in place, it's my opinion that the court, this would most likely wend its way to the court and be quickly struck down, I think starting right at the Second Circuit level, or maybe even at the district level, because there's already this decision out there. So it's not like we can go ahead and do it, even though what they passed was only for federal elections. We just aren't in a position to try to enact something that has already been ruled unconstitutional, and that could be rather costly, because as you may know, that in situations like this, in this case, the defendant would be required to pay the legal fees for the appellant as well.
We're talking on the Vermont Conversation with Vermont Secretary of State Jim Condos. You can join the conversation by calling 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. What you've mentioned, the influence of Lenore Broughton's super PAC, Vermonters First, having breached the $1 million private donation mark in the last election. Are there other notable new normals that we have in Vermont that you've seen in the last election or two, be it in statewide or in local, legislator races?
I haven't really seen any kind of an uptick, but I think that you're starting to see more dollars being raised and spent overall. I think this year, this is the first year that we have actually undertaken, as a result of this bill that was passed, undertaken local the filing of local campaign finance reports for select boards and city councils, and what we've definitely seen more filings there than had been reported in the past. So I think these races are starting to cost more as people are starting to ramp up a little bit, and partially to be prepared, but otherwise I think it's also to try to get the message out. And it's a difficult issue. I guess I'm really fearful that we're heading towards this oligarchy where big money and wealthy donors, are whether they be corporate or individual, will be ruling the country without input from anybody else. And to me, that is the wrong message to send across this country and certainly in the state of Vermont. You think, David, to the issue of just look at the presidential race. It was roughly $1 billion each spent between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. So that's $2 billion. That position only pays $400,000 in salary. So they spent $2 billion for a $400,000 position. And the same thing can be said for some of these other positions that are now starting to cost more money. It's gotten to the point, even in the governor's race now, where money is certainly going to be an issue going forward. But even a lot of the U.S. Senate and U.S. House races are now costing millions and millions of dollars.
Was the election when Governor Shumlin was first elected, was that a high water mark in terms of spending? And what kind of spending did we see from Senator Randy Brock and Governor Shumlin?
Well, in the first race, I think that former Lieutenant Governor Brian Doobie and at that time former Senator Peter Shumlin spent about the same in that first race. I forget exactly what the numbers were. I was running myself for the first time for the secretary's office. But I think in the second race, you had the governor spending approximately, well, no, he raised a lot of money, but the governor Shumlin only spent not very much. I mean, a couple hundred thousand dollars, $300,000 maybe. And former senator and auditor Randy Brock spent around $600,000, of which $300,000 was his own money.
Let's switch to voting rights. Last June, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 5-4 to overturn a key section of the Voting Rights Act, and Justice Ruth Ginsburg warned at that time that getting rid of the measure was quote like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you're not getting wet. She was referring to the case overturned the 1965, a part of the 1965 Voting Rights Act that required that lawmakers in states with a history of discriminating against minority voters get federal permission before changing voting rules. Now we see a new wave after this Supreme Court decision of voting restrictions happening in states, including voter ID laws, cutting voting hours, purging voter rolls, and ending same-day voter registration. You have sort of a national perspective on this. What do you see is happening, and what has been the role of secretaries of state in making these kind of restrictions on voting happen nationally?
Well, I do think that there is a potential danger. I want to say, though, that post 2010, even before the Supreme Court decision on the Voting Rights Act, a lot of these changes that you just mentioned were already occurring across the country. If you go back in history to the founding fathers and when this country first was formed, the only people that were allowed to vote at the time that the United States was formed were white male landowners. And we've come a long way since then. In almost every situation, I think there's been about 14 or 15 actual either amendments or laws that have been done that have been legislated. It was always to expand the voting registration, the voting eligibility, and I believe that this what we've seen since 2010, frankly, is the first time in our history, in the United States' history, where we're actually seeing a suppression of the vote going on around the country. And I'll just give you an example of what we did here in Vermont. And this was the positive, I think, and this is the message I take to my colleagues when the National Association of Secretaries of State gets together. The federal government passed a law called UACAVA, and this had to deal with overseas and military voters. They mandated in law that we had to be able to get those ballots to those military and overseas personnel at least 45, mail them out by 45 days ahead of time, ahead of the election. Vermont, at the time, their early vote period was 30 days, had a 30-day window. Vermont chose, and I was in the Senate when this happened, we chose to actually move this to match it up with the 45 days so that we would give even Vermonters the opportunity to be able to early vote. And by the way, our early vote system in Vermont, we don't really have absentee vote. We have early vote, and it's a no-fault, no-excuse voting procedure. You don't have to be sick. You don't have to be out of town. You don't have to make a reason up for why you want to vote early. You're just allowed to vote early. I think we have, when it comes to same-day voter registration, which is something that I think everyone knows that I support, but we do have same-day voter registration in Vermont up until the Wednesday before Election Day, and then we lock down the voter checklist. That is something that I would hope that the legislature would take up in the future. But all these different things that you see going out there with between voter ID, either eliminating or reducing the number of days you can early vote, putting restrictions on early vote or absentee vote. These are all designed really to suppress the vote, and it really, from my standpoint, is unconscionable. And I stated to my colleagues that the real voter fraud in this country is denying any eligible American their constitutional right to vote. That's the real voter fraud.
Okay, we're talking with Vermont Secretary of State Jim Condos. We have a caller on the line. John is calling from Barrie. John, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Yes, can you hear me all right? I'm on the edge of the interstate here.
Yes, we can hear you.
Oh, okay. Yes, I've been a justice of the peace in Barrie for many years now. I work at the polls on Election Day. But as I was listening to your conversation in the car here, one of the things that's being ignored in this whole mess, I heard the part about Broughton. If you are trying to unseat an incumbent both at the national level and state level, and our Vermont legislature is a big example, a challenger has a very poor chance of knocking off an incumbent.
John, you're breaking up here, so if you could get to your question, we can let Secretary of State Condos answer it.
Could you answer my question? How does a challenger offset the power of the bully pulpit that so badly abused here and in the nation? Because without money to challenge, the people already holding the seat have an enormous amount of power, and I'll hang up.
Okay.
Thank you.
So that's a great question, and actually the law that was ruled unconstitutional back from 97, we actually had limits that would say that an incumbent can only spend 85% there was a limit on expenditures that was put in place, and that was ruled unconstitutional almost immediately, and that was reduced so that an incumbent could only spend 85% of what a challenger could spend. So that was one way that the legislature had looked at it. But as I said, that was ruled unconstitutional. Really, I think the gentleman raises the point. You know, when someone has a bully pulpit, and essentially you got to hope your voice is louder, and that you have good ideas, and that you make the efforts to contact people and meet those voters and explain your positions. It's difficult, I think, but I think it's the nature of the beast. It's what we have. I think going forward, to put it bluntly, the only real way to overcome all of this, there's two ways. One, first of all, you got to look at what the courts have left us, and they haven't left us much. Essentially, they've left us with disclosure. My office is, right now, we've just started with a vendor to put in a complete new elections management system that will include a new campaign finance system, and we will have immediate and up-to-date disclosure by candidates going forward. It'll be searchable, so someone can put in a company's name and find out if that company has donated to which candidates, or you can search by the individual's name, the candidate's name, and then we're also the other way really is something that we are just barely touching on. We just made some changes to it this year, and for the first time in several years, we'll have our first publicly financed candidate. But I think that public financing is a way that can overcome some of this issue. But you got to have the political will to go forward with public financing. But if you look, Maine and Connecticut both have public financing, and I believe in both the number of legislators is about 85%, 80 to 85% of the legislatures in Maine and Connecticut are using public financing. And I think
we can
overcome this.
We're out of time here, so we're going to have to leave it there. So I want to thank you, Secretary of State Jim Condos, and that'll do it for this week's Vermont Conversation.
And you're listening to Locally Owned and Operated, 96.1 WDEV FM in Warren, FM 96.5 in Barrie, AM 550 WDEV Waterbury, Montpelier, the friendly pioneer. Serving the kingdom at FM 101.9 from Island Pond. It's 2 o'clock.
AP Radio News.